Today I'm going to talk about the economy, but not potentially in the way you may expect. What I'm going to do is divide this talk into two parts. A factual part that lays out the evidence that Idaho is not doing well in economic terms, and a prescriptive part that focuses on why Idaho is now performing so poorly and what we should be doing about it. First, the facts. And I should say that you have on your tables a single sheet handout that I prepared. One of the things that being an economist comes hand in hand with is numbers. And this is probably the first speech I've given in I don't know how long that I haven't had the assistance of visual aids, i.e. PowerPoints. So I had to take a PowerPoint presentation and condense it all into one sheet, and that's what you have on your table. But I'm not going to be talking specifically about the information in the sheet, but it will relate to the things that I'm going to talk about. And my understanding is that that will also be available on the City Club website for the remote listeners. So back to the facts. To hear the governor tell it, Idaho's economy is doing quite well, thank you. After all, we're getting close to his Project 60 target of $60 billion in Idaho gross state product. And soon that goal will be in his rearview mirror. It's not an exaggeration to say that pretty much sums up what the governor had to say about Idaho's economy in his State of the State budget message he delivered in early January. It would be polite to describe his treatment of the economy as lip service. Nowhere does the governor acknowledge the difficulties Idaho is facing in terms of other important economic metrics. It's true that Idaho's GSP is growing, and so is Idaho personal income and Idaho employment. But unless we're in an actual recession, these things usually do grow. Just having them grow is no exceptional accomplishment. It's when you look beyond simple growth rates and start comparing Idaho's economic performance to the rest of the nation that the full measure of our recent economic failings becomes clear. Not long ago, Idaho had the distinction of being one of the best performing states in the nation. From the late 1980s to the middle of the 2000s, Idaho was consistently ranked among the top performing states in terms of employment, income, and output growth. And perhaps most importantly, Idaho was among the very best performing states in the nation in terms of our per capita income growth. In 1986, Idaho per capita personal income stood at 76.8% of the U.S. average and was ahead of only three other states. Over the next decade, Idaho per capita income grew to almost 85% of the U.S. average and topped almost a dozen other states. After two decades in 2006, Idaho per capita personal income had slipped a bit to 83.5% of the U.S. average, but we were still ahead of eight other states. Over that two-decade period, Idaho per capita personal income had grown faster than all but four states and the District of Columbia. To put it mildly, we were on a roll. For many, what I just described is the Idaho economic story. Sure, we just experienced a nasty economic downturn, but so did everybody else. And we're clearly on the mend, so the return of happy days are just ahead. We just need to get that pesky housing bubble and the financial meltdown behind us. Wrong. What many Idahoans don't realize is that Idaho has gone from being at the top of the charts, the little economic engine that could, to being the nation's economic caboose. Sure, we're seeing signs of economic improvement. So is virtually every other state. Jobs are growing, unemployment is declining, output is increasing, and so is income. But when we look at Idaho's economic performance over the last quarter century, the recent setback is stunning and the results are depressing. Probably no measure better captures the recent economic fate of Idahoans than per capita personal income. Since 2006, Idaho has lost 4.4 percentage points to the U.S. average, dropping from 83.5 in 2006 to 79.1% in 2011. That's a loss of two-thirds of the gain that we made in the previous two decades. It also means that Idaho has been eclipsed by seven of the eight states that we were ahead of in 2006. Now we're ahead of just one state, Mississippi. If Idaho had maintained its income level at 83.5% of the U.S. average, it would have remained ahead of seven of the eight states we bested in 2006, and every man, woman, and child in Idaho would have, on average, had an additional $1,813 of annual personal income. So what happened to the eight states that had income below Idaho in 2006? Over the past 5 years, they all had per capita personal income growth significantly higher than Idaho's. That's how seven of them beat us. The one state that remained below us in 2011, Mississippi, had per capita personal income growth that was over three times greater than Idaho's over the last 5 years. And while they didn't surpass us, they closed the gap from 9.5 percentage points in 2006 to just 2.1 percentage points in 2011. That's all that separates us from the bottom of the barrel. So who are the states that overtook us in the past 5 years? Alabama, Arkansas, Kentucky, New Mexico, South Carolina, Utah, and West Virginia. Perhaps as stunning as the loss in our ranking based on the level of income is the loss in our ranking based on the growth in our per capita personal income. From 1986 to 2006, per capita personal income grew faster in Idaho than all but four other states and the District of Columbia. From 2006 to 2011, Idaho per capita personal income grew more slowly than all but three states. Clearly, something is going wrong. Now, the data on per capita personal income currently only goes through 2011, with 2012 data slated to be released exactly 2 weeks from today. It's impossible to say with certainty what the data will show, but recent circumstantial evidence doesn't bode well for improvement. 2 weeks ago, the Idaho Department of Labor reported in 2012, Idaho had a 63% increase in the number of Idahoans holding minimum wage jobs, catapulting the Gem State into first place in a race where you want to be last. When we compare ourselves to Washington, the state with the highest minimum wage, Idaho actually has more workers in raw numbers, 31,000, than our neighbor to the west, 29,000. And by the way, Washington's economy is four times the size of Idaho's. So now to the prescription. How did Idaho get to this place of economic underperformance, and what can be done about it? To answer these questions, a little history and historical context is necessary. We need to go back to the 60s, when the economy was good and the music was even better. And I was there. During the 60s, Idaho was confronted with serious challenges in funding its public schools. In a nutshell, a forward-thinking governor, Robert Smiley, and a Republican legislature did the unthinkable. They raised taxes. And not just any tax. They implemented an entirely new tax, the sales tax. At a 3% rate, it generated what in today's terms would be a whopping $600 million of new revenue. And where did that revenue go? You guessed it. It went to schools. Public schools, community colleges, colleges and universities, professional technical education all got substantial increases in state funding. 3 years before the sales tax was implemented, Idaho spent a total of $48.7 million on education, 3.6% of Idaho personal income. 3 years after the sales tax came to be, Idaho was spending $99.9 million on education, 5.3% of Idaho personal income. So with such a large tax increase, how did Idaho's economy fare? In a word, spectacularly. For a decade after the tax hike, Idaho's economy powered through a U.S. recession in the late 1960s, like it wasn't there, and had a very mild downturn in the mid-70s when the U.S. experienced one of the worst downturns of the post-war period. In fact, the entire decade of the 70s was one of the best in terms of economic performance in Idaho's modern history. Good as the 70s were, alas, it could not last forever. In the early 1980s, the U.S. suffered what would become its worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. This time, Idaho was not immune and went into its worst downturn since World War II. After 3 straight years of employment loss, Idaho once again did the unthinkable. It raised taxes. Between 1983, the bottom of the Idaho downturn, and 1987, the year Idaho's economy finally took off, the governor, this time John Evans, and the Republican legislature raised Idaho taxes by $500 million in today's terms. The sales tax rate went from 3% to 5%. The individual income tax went from 7.5% to 8.2%, and the corporate income tax rate went from 6.5% to 8%. All told, these increases raised revenue by about 1% of Idaho personal income. And where do you suppose the revenue went? That's right, Idaho schools. General fund expenditures for public schools went from 2.2% of Idaho personal income in 1982 to 2.8% of Idaho personal income in 1988. All general fund education spending went from 3.2% in 82 to 4% in 1988. That's of personal income. Now, once again, by today's standards, a $500 million tax increase should kill the economy, right? Nope. In late 1987, Idaho's economy took off, once again completely skipped the next U.S. recession, that was in 1991, and was only mildly impacted by the next recession, 2001. But that was then, and this is now. As I mentioned at the beginning, Idaho's economy is not doing well. Idaho has gone from being at the top of the charts to scraping rock bottom. So what changed? In a word, taxes. Idaho went from being a state that was frugal but willing to step up to preserve public services to a state in a race to the bottom. And the sad reality is we seem to be winning the race. Now, you may have noticed I did a bit of sleight of hand switching smoothly from taxes to public services. Well, it's not trickery. The reality is that taxes and public services are just two sides of the same coin. This is particularly true in the case of state governments, where balanced budget requirements ensure that expenditures can't exceed revenue, at least for very long. Starting in about the year 2000, Idaho embarked on a much different fiscal path. In 2000, we cut individual income tax rates and added inflation indexing. In 2001, we cut individual rates again and cut the corporate income tax rate. And we exempted ag personal property and paid that off to local governments from the top of the sales tax. In 2006, we swapped sales tax for property tax, supposedly to fund public schools, at a net revenue loss of $50 million in the first year. That cost eventually grew to over $160 million, but has since settled back. In 2008, we boosted the grocery credit from $20 to $100, but softened the blow by phasing it in. We're still phasing it in. That year, we also enacted a business personal property tax exemption that's on the books, but still waiting to be triggered. Last year, we picked up where we left off in 2001, and we cut the individual and corporate income tax rates some more. In fact, we now have the lowest top income tax rate since 1934, and we've only had the income tax in Idaho since 1931. All told, the tax cuts Idaho has enacted since 2000 add up to about $350 million in today's terms. That's a reversal of about two-thirds of the revenue Idaho raised in the middle of the 1980s. And now we're looking at yet another big tax cut, this time the complete elimination of business personal property from the property tax. Enact that, and we will have effectively reversed the entire revenue gains that were made in the 1980s. And even though not all of these tax cuts have completely taken effect, the latest Idaho Tax Commission comparative tax burden report for fiscal year 2010 shows we hit a new benchmark, Idaho is now, for the first time, dead last in terms of our overall tax burden. To be fair, that's on a per capita basis. When we look at Idaho's overall tax burden on an income-adjusted basis, we're 46th, a new record low for Idaho, but not the bottom of the barrel yet. So shouldn't we be celebrating these record low taxes? Yesterday, I heard the governor's commerce director testify that we need to fully exempt business personal property so we can, quote, drive business operating costs in Idaho to the lowest point possible, unquote. That apparently is this administration's economic development strategy. It's not working. If the question is, when are we going to see results? My answer is not until we come to our senses. Over a decade ago, we started cutting taxes. Today, we not only cut taxes, we lowball revenue forecasts and park the resulting revenue surpluses offline, preventing those tax dollars from working, preventing those tax dollars from matching federal tax or federal Medicaid match 2-to-1, preventing those tax dollars from giving our school children a 5-day school week. Business should constantly strive to lower its costs. So should government. But there's a difference between prudent cost cutting and irresponsible hacking of vital systems. In the 1980s and 90s, we spent 4.4% of our personal income on public schools. Since 2001, there's been an almost straight line decline. Today's executive budget has that down to 3.4% of our personal income. That's a 23% decline. In 2001, we spent $212 million general fund dollars on colleges and universities. 11 years later, in 2012, we spent $209 million. In 2011, we cut $35 million of general fund dollars from Medicaid, losing over $70 million in federal match in the bargain. In 2012, we had some surplus revenue. Did we restore the Medicaid cuts? No. We eliminated the top individual income tax bracket and cut the corporate income tax rate at a combined cost of $36 million. And the Medicaid cuts remain. The simple fact is we are not making wise investments in our people. Almost two-thirds of the general fund goes to education. One-quarter goes to health and human services. Almost 10% goes to public safety. A scant 4% goes to everything else. When we cut taxes, we cut human services. We cut investments in our children. We make it harder for adults to adapt to an ever-changing economic landscape. We hurt ourselves. Thank you.
You've been listening to Mike Ferguson with the Idaho Center for Fiscal Policy. And Mike, you've laid out a pretty clear case here regarding Idaho's fiscal policy. So I have a number of questions and am happy to get a few more up here. Let me begin with some around some of the policy proposals in front of the Idaho legislature. I want to begin with health care. Recently, Time magazine described a health care economy that is thriving but at the expense of the rest of the economy. Do you see this divide in Idaho, and what does it mean for our future?
Well, I don't know that the differences between Idaho and the rest of the nation amount to a whole lot in terms of the health care situation in the country. I mean, as a nation, we have the circumstance of having the highest share of our nation's GDP going to health care costs, and we're the only developed nation that doesn't provide 100% coverage for all of our citizens for basic health care. It is consuming a great amount of our economic resources, and it has an enormous impact. Now, to bring it down to the state level, there's obviously a big debate going on in the legislature about the issue of a state versus a federal health exchange. Frankly, I think that is less of an issue than the question of expanding Medicaid. As you probably all know...
You've hit my next two questions.
Thanks, Dick. As you probably all know, The governor had two task forces over the summer that looked at the question of health exchanges and Medicaid expansion, which was made optional by a recent Supreme Court decision. Now, I give kudos to the governor for doing that. I think that was a very smart thing to do, and those task forces or working groups both came out with recommendations that Idaho should adopt a state health exchange, which the governor then endorsed, and also recommended unanimously, and this had some pretty conservative members on the working group. They also recommended that the state expand its Medicaid system to include up to 138% of the poverty level. The governor chose not to recommend that. I don't know that he ruled it out, but he said he wasn't prepared to make that recommendation. Just yesterday, a very conservative legislator, Tom Lurcher, announced that he was going to be introducing legislation to, in fact, extend Idaho's Medicaid coverage under the optional expansion. The benefit of that is you get basically 3 years of 100% match. In other words, the federal government pays for 3 years, and those are all new dollars that come into the state. And after 3 years, it drops back to a 90% match, which is way better than the 70% match we have now on the Medicaid program that currently exists. So it would be an enormously beneficial to the state, both from a macroeconomic standpoint in terms of bringing in those dollars. Right now, those people, when they have healthcare costs, they come into hospitals. We have a system of indigent care at the county level and a catastrophic fund at the state level that basically pays those expenses without any leverage, if you will, from the federal government. So that would be smart economically, and I think it would be smart from a moral or ethical standpoint.
So let me just try to get you to draw, connect the dots between this Medicaid expansion proposal and the state's economic development policy. The spending of these additional federal dollars on Medicaid programs would also mean new jobs for healthcare providers and caregivers, would they not?
Well, I think that's basically a secondary impact. Clearly, it would bring new dollars into the state that would have beneficial economic impact, but I don't think that can be the cornerstone of an economic development strategy. But I think in terms of the points that I've made in my prepared remarks and some of the rather weak economic performance we've had in the recent past, I mean, we went into the Great Recession earlier, we went in deeper, and we've come out slower than most other states. It was a pretty profound impact in terms of Idaho's economy and what we had all come to think of as this successful little engine that could. Well, part of this is self-inflicted. I mean, when you start cutting out pieces of the state's programs that have federal matches, or in the case of education, those dollars are going to basically be spent locally. The first round is going as salaries to teachers. I mean, those things will impact the economy in the short run and do have a macroeconomic effect.
Well, we already heard what you thought of the governor's economic policy in terms of this Project 60, but what do you think about, there's a bill in front of the Idaho legislature right now to put up a $3 million into a war chest for business recruitment. Surely that's a good thing.
Well, let me say this, that I far prefer the light of day to the cover of darkness for our economic development strategy. And let me explain what I mean by that. I think spending programs, in other words, putting the resources that we want to allocate for economic development on the table so that it is there in plain sight for all to see and assess, is a good thing. The problem when we have an economic development policy that focuses on tax breaks, tax cuts, doing those sorts of things, those are done behind basically laws that say the public doesn't have access to that information. So it's very difficult to assess whether you're having success. One of the aspects of using tax policy to try to promote economic development is it's sort of like that old shotgun to kill a fly argument. You're going to, in large numbers of cases, be paying for things that you would have happen anyway in order to get a little bitty increment of additional economic activity. So it generally tends also to not be a very efficient way. So I do tend to like programs that identify a strategy, put the money on the table, and then have a conscious decision made on how those resources are allocated. I mean, that's how we do the budget for the things that are the core functions. And I would say this, that probably the best economic development strategy a state can have is to have the best possible state government it can in terms of providing those core functions, education, health and human services, public safety, and then there's a whole myriad of other smaller ones that are important as well, but too numerous to mention. So I think losing sight of those core functions is really, really important.
Okay, Mike, you attribute Idaho's glory days to increases in taxes and education spending. And we have a couple other alternate theories here. Don't you think that the existence of Fortune 500 companies in Idaho, such as Albertsons, Morrison Knudsen, Orida, et cetera, had an impact on per capita income?
Sure. But I'm not an accountant. I'm an economist. And you can't trace directly from point A to point B to point C. When we lose those companies, one of the things that I have to ask myself is, how attractive is this state to the kind of people that are going to be employed by those companies, who probably care a great deal about the quality of the education system that their children are going to be confronted with, and in the case of their employees, the quality of the education system that their employees have access to enhance their productivity. So I don't think, granted, we have lost some corporate headquarters here, and the reasons are complex, but I think not taking care of these basics is an important element.
Here's a couple other alternative theories here. How much of Idaho's economic woes are due to the destruction of our labor movement? And then related to that is how much of the decline in personal per capita income is due to the freeze on public employee salaries?
Well, as far as the labor union issue goes, I'm assuming that that refers to Idaho's adopting right to work. And in general, that's an open question, and the studies I've seen give relatively unclear marks in terms of the extent of the role of that in impacting economic performance. That did happen in the 80s. It did happen coincident with the tax increases that I mentioned in the mid-80s, but it didn't happen in the 60s, and it didn't change since 2000. So I guess the point I would make is that is one of a multitude of factors that drive ultimately the underpinnings of the economy. But what I would basically hasten to point out is that I'm not arguing that increasing taxes is what leads to economic prosperity. I'm arguing that public services are important for economic prosperity. We often get in this mode of having this tension, this competition between government on the one hand and the private sector on the other. They're complementary. They need each other. And I don't see how basically driving down our public services to the rock bottom ultimately helps. In the Business Insider a few weeks ago, there was a story that talked about Idaho's wage performance, real wage performance, over the last several decades. And the headline was that Idaho real wages had only grown 3.4% over the last three decades. The subtitle was Massachusetts grew 46.5% for the same metric. So, I don't know.
Well, you offered me a great segue to this next question. Still staying on the same labor topic, I think economists like Peter Crabb here at the head table would probably say that a time of high unemployment is not the best time to think about raising the minimum wage. And yet the Obama administration has proposed raising the minimum wage from $7 to $9 an hour. What do you think about that, and how would it affect both the national and the state economy?
Well, again, I'm a little ambivalent on that because, as an economist, I mean, there are trade-offs here, and there are offsetting impacts, and the question is, where do they fall? I mean, you boost wages at the bottom to some degree, but you also potentially throw some people out of work. What the net effect is and whether it's a net positive or a net negative, I'm not sure. I don't know that it's really the biggest issue that we have confronting us in terms of our industrial and economic policies. I think things like corporate governance, tax policies, make a whole lot more difference in terms of what happens in our economy and how the wealth generated by the economy is distributed across the various elements of the economy.
Well, let me ask you another kind of timing issue on national macroeconomic policies. There are those who still believe in Keynesian thought, believe that the stimulus package was an appropriate way to bring the United States economy out of the fiscal crisis that we found ourselves in a few years ago. That led to high deficit spending. Now there's a call for austerity measures and reducing spending. Is the timing right for that call, or is it a partisan motivation?
Answer to the first question is no, and I'll forego the second question.
So if the timing's not right, what should we be doing with regard to the deficit?
Well, I mean, the deficit is not a good thing, clearly, but when the Great Recession happened in late 2007, we had a particular hand that we were dealt. And that hand that we had been dealt had been evolving over the prior roughly three decades. I mean, when I was in graduate school, I remember studying macroeconomics, and monetary policy and fiscal policy were on an equal footing in a sense. They were both legitimate ways for the government, and here I'm talking the national government, the sovereign government of the United States, to basically conduct its economic policies. They were macroeconomic levers, so to speak. And they had pluses and minuses. Monetary policy could be enacted quickly, but it took time to work its way through the economy. Fiscal policy could have its impact almost immediately, but it took its time getting it through the Congress. They have different characteristics. But what I found when we came into the episode of the Great Recession was I hadn't really been paying close attention to the lofty world of macroeconomics, but fiscal policy had been pretty much cast aside and rendered deemed to be ineffective and inappropriate, and everything rested on monetary policy. Well, we've sort of been going into new territory because monetary policy depends in part on being able to manipulate short-term interest rates, and when short-term interest rates are essentially at zero, you don't have any more room to bring down interest rates. So we've seen things like quantitative easing. The fact that we're not willing to acknowledge that fiscal policy is a legitimate macroeconomic policy lever available to the federal government, I think, is tragic. And it goes back, again, I mentioned the three decades. Starting roughly in the mid-70s, we went from having fiscal policy that ran deficits and surpluses in such a way that we didn't have an increase in our debt overall to running deficits in both the bad times, the troughs, when you need it to fill in the trough, and the good times when you're at a peak and the economy is overheating and you should be shaving it off. We were still running deficits. So we weren't doing a thing, the smart thing in terms of fiscal policy over that period, which built up our national debt. I was asked once, how did the United States pay off the national debt that it incurred after World War II, and it was over 100% of GDP. And when you go in and you look at the numbers, what you realize is that we didn't pay the debt off. That debt at the end of World War II was about $300 billion. In the early 70s, it was about $300 billion. What we did was we grew the economy. It became a smaller share of our GDP and thereby became more manageable. So the fact that our whole perspective on fiscal policy is as warped as it is, and we're in this bad situation of three decades of building up our debt to a point where we don't have the latitude that we would like to have, I think is sad. But given where we are, I think we do need to recognize that the alternative may be worse. By not stimulating the economy, we could actually end up making the deficit worse.
Okay. Your opening comments focused on a longing for more Idaho tax revenue to be put into our education system. This question says, please comment on the $2.2 billion in tax expenditures, which means either tax credits or tax deductions, that neither the governor nor the legislature will address.
Well, what Dick's referring to is basically work that's done by our former stomping ground, the Division of Financial Management, that produces a tax structure analysis. We used to call it a tax expenditure study, but some folks didn't like the name, so we had to change it to Idaho's exemptions, credits, deductions, and one other thing I don't remember. But in any event, I was actually responsible for producing that report, and it looked really at the tax expenditures related to two things, the income tax and the sales tax. And I think what gets the most attention is the vast amount of the sales tax that is not in the base. In other words, what are the taxable what are the transactions that logically should be subject to taxation but are not because of exemptions? And just this week, we're on the way to having yet another one. Girl Scout cookies are going to get a sales tax exemption. Now, I have nothing against Girl Scouts, but I wonder what the civic lesson is to take a bunch of little Girl Scouts in and show them that by lobbying the legislature, they can get their special interest tax break. I'm not sure. Anyway.
You think a better lesson would be for them to learn that paying some taxes to further their public education might be a good thing.
Well put, Dick. Well put. But to get back to your question, you know, I've done some analysis and given some speeches and been critical of the exemption of business personal property. Part of the reason that I'm disturbed, I guess, is because what that would do is it would further reduce the revenue stream coming into the state of Idaho, because it would be replaced, the local losses would be largely replaced by state revenue without any enhancement of revenues at the state level. So it would further tighten the screws down on the money that's available for those essential public services that I mentioned. I'm not opposed to taking a look at business personal property tax along with everything else and looking, basically making a comprehensive top-to-bottom examination of the tax structure and determining what it should look like, what the level of revenues need to be to provide the level of services that are consistent with a thriving, vibrant economy. And I guess I'm not terribly optimistic at this moment that we'll see that anytime soon, but I think we'll eventually get there. Now, back in, I think it was 2003, I was interviewed by, I think it was The Nation magazine, and they asked me what one of my greatest moments was in my career. And one of the things that I said was working for Dirk Kempthorne when he, in a very memorable speech in his State of the State message, said that he was not going to preside over the dismantling of state government and proceeded to recommend a 1.5 cent sales tax increase for 3 years. Now, That turned into the longest legislative session in Idaho's history by a wide margin. It didn't break the record. It shattered it. And in the end, he basically got 1 cent for 2 years, and it did the trick. It bridged the gap, and we didn't see. I mean, we had already been making cuts. There had been significant reductions in terms of the funds that were available for public services. But he came to a point where he realized that he had to draw the line. And I think that took a lot of courage. It went against every grain in his body, but he did it.
So if I'm hearing you correct, you say the personal property tax cut should be put up and compared with the rest of those $2.2 billion in tax expenditures.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's happened over time is we have seen, and this year is a good example. I mean, we're probably going to give this little tiny, I think it's $140,000 exemption for Girl Scout cookies. But over the years, we keep adding and adding and adding to the exemptions. That's part of what Dick's talking about. But there's another part. When the sales tax was enacted in 1965, about 40% of the economy was services, and about 60% of the economy was goods transactions. Today, it's the opposite. Services have become a much bigger part of the economy, and yet our sales tax is not reflecting that modern reality. Now, there are a number of states that do completely, more or less, tax services. New Mexico is one of them. Hawaii is one. I think maybe South Dakota, but they're far and few between. That's a tough nut to crack. It really, really is. There have been states that have done it and then retreated because of the pushback. But I think at some point you get to the point where that has to be given serious consideration, and that's where a lot of the money is. What Dick's talking about is there are more dollars in exemptions from the sales tax than there are in collections from the sales tax. And that's growing for two reasons: the evolution of the economy into an ever larger service component and the unending addition of new good causes.
Well, maybe it's time for a quick shout out for the goods producing part of the economy. And I believe we just broke them. We're going to hold. Okay, you're right, I did. I got Dick Rush here from the Farm Service Agency, and he says that the Idaho farm income has set record highs the past 3 years. So what shape would our economy be in if this were not the case? If, in other words, shouldn't we be grateful for our goods producing economy?
Let's trade off. Okay. Well, I think the goods producing economy is very important. It is center stage in terms of what many folks believe is a serious decline in terms of our nation's economic well-being. I think Idaho, by and large, has done well in terms of supporting the goods producing sector. And, there's this notion that, well, we have the resource industries, things like forest products and agriculture that are low tech, and then we have high tech manufacturing, things like Micron or ON Semiconductor, whatnot. Well, pretty much any manufacturing is going to be high tech, even in agriculture. I mean, farmers are adding GPS receivers to their tractors. They're doing surveys of the land to determine how to most efficiently lay down their fertilizer. Technology is everywhere, and these various parts of the economy are all important. I would just like to see more of the jobs such as, say, Chobani brought, as opposed to more call centers. Nothing against call centers, and those are jobs too, but they're very volatile if you look at the history of jobs in Idaho.
Got a question here about the role of higher education. It notes that despite our low spending per pupil, Idaho has been pretty successful in maintaining a high graduation rate from high school, but that only 4 out of 10 go on to college. That's very low rate compared to national levels, and how does that affect our economy?
And I think even fewer come out of higher education with a degree. And the State Board of Education has recently acknowledged that and set a goal of having 60% completion of higher education or some certification program. That's important. I mean, we do get good bang for the buck in Idaho relative to what we spend. I mean, make no mistake, we are not rock bottom performance-wise, but we're not that far off the bottom. I mean, I don't think we get the kind of spectacular results we would like. And when it comes to higher education, one of the things that I would point out is we have some issues in terms of the expense of higher education. You already see from the handout on your tables and the comments I made that we are relatively low, second to last, in terms of our per capita income. Take a look at what the relationship is for our neighboring states. When we hear the folks in our education community talk about, well, our costs, the tuition and fees are comparable to neighboring states or competitive, well, we don't have the same resources. And I think that's a big factor in terms of what those completion rates are, because it's expensive to go to college. There's no way around that. And I guess I see that as really, really important, because it's not about equal outcomes. It's about an equal, fair place at the starting line. And that's why when I was interviewed recently about the high rate of minimum wage jobs, I said, well, my policy prescription for Idaho is to focus on education, 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 in that order. And that means preschool, that means K-12, and that means higher education. And you're not going to get instant results, but I think you do get dividends over time because you're making investments in human capital.
And those investments in education increase your labor productivity and therefore your wages. Have a geographic question. We talked about kind of how Idaho was doing statewide, but is rural Idaho suffering the brunt of the decline, and is the Boise metro area doing relatively better within the state?
I haven't been paying as close attention to that as I did once when I was responsible for doing economic forecasts, but what I can say is that when Idaho went into the Great Recession, the impacts were much harsher in terms of the Treasure Valley. The impacts on the high-tech manufacturing sector were pretty significant. We were also in the process of losing one of our major Fortune 500 companies. Some of the processing jobs stayed, but they were basically absorbed into a company out of Albertsons. So initially, I think the urban area of Idaho, Boise, had the biggest impact. I think now my sense is that it's coming back a little bit more strongly than some of the rural areas.
Driven in large part by entrepreneurs?
Well, I mean, it's driven in part by we're seeing a bottoming out of the housing market. There's been some new construction projects. Entrepreneurs obviously play a role, but I can't say that I've studied that carefully enough to say yay or nay that that's the driving force.
I have one more serious question before we begin our wrap-up here. This is a rather plaintive question, and the questioner says, I'm 34 and a woman. Should I stay here? Mr. Gloom and Doom, dismal economist.
Oh, wow, that's a trap. Sure, after you get your college education. No. Yeah, because I think we need people who are willing to be engaged and to look at the policies that our political leaders are engaged in and try to make an improvement. Now, if that's a 34-year-old school teacher, I'd say things are kind of grim, because what I've been hearing is that the school districts around the state, particularly near border states, are having a devil of a time keeping people that are remotely footloose in their school districts. So, you know, it's hard to say that things are bright and cheery, but I love Idaho, much as it may not seem that way, and I'm certainly not going here, but then I'm pretty close to retirement, too.
All right. Well, hey, before I ask this last question, I want to offer Mike the much-envied City Club coffee mug. I think you'll have a match set now as a token of appreciation. Now, Mike, as you may recall, is a noted prognosticator. In fact, he once won a bet for Cecil Andrus. No?
Well, he made the bet. I didn't win the
bet. Yes, but he bet on you, your prognostication ability. So let me ask this question. When will Bogus Basin get some decent snow?
When hell freezes over?
Well, not this year.
Not this year. Okay. Well, I'm Dick Gardner. You've been listening to the City Club of Boise's Forum on the Idaho Economy with Mike Ferguson, Director of the Idaho Fiscal Policy Center. Our next programs will be forums on March 29 on the film Gideon's Army, and another forum on the history of Boise that will be part of the Boise Sesquicentennial Celebration on April 25th. You can register at cityclubofboise.org or at Facebook. Hope to see you there. Thank you.